Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everybody. We've got a great one today. You know, for a change, Frank Foer is with me. And if you listen to the podcast regularly, you certainly know Frank, who is part of the pantheon of our greatest guests. Frank writes for the Atlantic Monthly, and today we discuss his epic piece in this newest Atlantic, The Golden Age of American Jews is Ending. Yikes! It's a scary piece for us Jews. We've seen anti-Semitism on the right, from Nazis marching in Skokie in 1977. That was a famous Supreme Court case. American Nazis marched in Skokie, Illinois, home to many Holocaust survivors. The ACLU famously fought in court for their right, the Nazis' right, to march there. And, you know, First Amendment. Charlottesville, of course, in 2017. By the way, the one in Skokie was very peaceful, very peaceful. Not so in Charlottesville. Neo-Nazis and Klansmen and your garden variety right-wing assholes marched chanting, "Jews will not replace us." And, of course, that turned violent. And Trump, of course, said there were good people on both sides. That's your garden variety right-wing anti-Semitism. And now anti-Semitism on the left is raising its ugly head. And Frank writes about that. And it threatens this golden age for American Jews, which really started post-World War II in the wake of the Holocaust and the birth of Israel, and which I was the beneficiary of, the golden age of American Jews. I was the beneficiary of that growing up in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. My family, we were lower middle class or something like that, but I felt like the luckiest kid in the world because I was. I grew up in a suburb of Minneapolis, St. Louis Park, which was called St. Jewish Park because it was 20% Jewish. And in Minnesota, that's a lot of Jews. At the time in Minnesota, any Jews was a lot of Jews. That was our license plate, in fact, until 1957. But St. Louis Park was an amazing place to grow up in. Norm Ornstein, part of our pantheon, also of great guests here on the podcast, is from St. Louis Park. Tom Friedman, who is 2 years younger than me, also from St. Louis Park. And we were all the beneficiary of this golden age of American Jews, which Frank makes a very scary case that anti-Semitism undeniably is rising on the left. And Frank chronicles that in his amazing piece in The Atlantic, the overt anti-Semitism we are seeing on the left, and not just on college campuses in the wake of Gaza. Anyway, Frank Foer is with us and makes a very scary case, which is that the golden age for American Jews is maybe coming to a close. Okay, I'm recording this on Friday, March 8th, the morning after Biden's State of the Union address. Peter, I know you watched, as you always do.
I did, yeah, I watched.
I thought Biden danced the hully gully on Mike Johnson's Adam's apple last night.
It's very well said. Yes, it was odd. It was odd to watch Mike Johnson.
Yes. Now he hasn't been there long, and he just seemed to be completely puzzled about how he should react. Reading him was just the most interesting thing for me all night, because he went through every emotion. It seemed he went through everything. Like, should I be? I don't like this. Should I be showing that? Should I not be showing that? Should I? Okay, I have to applaud this, but I don't want to be seen applauding it. So I'm going to applaud below the desk here. It was fun to watch him. I couldn't take my eyes off of him.
I had a similar reaction, and I specifically always enjoy watching the speaker during these because, you know, we saw Boehner during Obama's State of the Unions, and we saw Nancy Pelosi during Trump, and it's always kind of fun to watch someone that speaker that's in the opposition have to kind of balance that when the president from the opposing party is speaking.
Yeah, I also remember when Quayle was vice president. That was also fun to watch the vice president then. But no, in this case, Johnson just looked so uncomfortable. It was great. And I loved how Biden kept referring to Trump as my predecessor. Because you think, like, how's he going to talk about Trump? And my predecessor means the guy I beat by 7 million votes. And I just thought Biden became the old war horse in the best possible way. I thought that's what I was thinking last night. He was combative. There was a moment when he was talking about the bill that Lankford had negotiated, the border bill, which was very, very, very much a Republican bill that was going to pass in the Senate until Trump said, no, I don't want a bill because I want something. I want a campaign issue, and I don't want this corrected. I don't want anything helping the border situation at all. So, and then the Republicans folded, and I just thought that because he said to him, "Oh, I thought you liked that bill." And then remember, he said something about what was in the bill, and they went, "No, no," but Lankford was on Lankford. And not only did he nod, but he actually mouthed, yeah, it was, you know, I don't know. It was, yeah. We'll see how this plays out. You know, I don't know if a lot of the low information voters were watching. That's part of the problem always.
Well, I could say this because I watch with my 19-year-old son who gets to vote for the first time this year.
And who is appalled at having to vote for guys this old. For two guys this old.
Yes, he's not super thrilled. He's not thrilled about these two guys being the choice.
But what did he say? Because you've been telling me about what he's been saying all along. So what did he say after this?
He watched it, and he just said, I didn't know Biden was able to do this.
I think a lot of people thought that.
I think you're right.
I think a lot of people thought that. But I'm glad your son, because I've been getting a running commentary on what he's been thinking, and he just basically until this reaction had been very, he didn't even know exactly if he was going to vote for Biden.
That's right. Yeah.
You're in Maryland now.
We're in Maryland now. He's definitely not voting for Trump. He's made that clear, but he also said, I don't know if I can vote for Biden. And after last night, he said, I think he's got more in him than people give him credit for.
I think that's clearly was the message from last night. And we'll see. We'll see. Well, it didn't make people more anti-Semitic, so that's good. Frank Foer is a gift to us, and this is a very scary article to me, which about the sort of the end of this grace period for Jews that started really, I guess, after World War II because of the Holocaust. And after Gaza, we've been seeing it on college campuses, Frank takes us to the Bay Area, where it was very, very present in not just high schools, but in junior highs and in grade schools. It's just a very, to me as a Jew, a very eye-opening article. So let's go to Frank now. It is a great one this week, you know, for a change.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant eraser foundation.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We should start at the beginning by saying we're both Jewish.
Is this a Jew, not a Jew segment?
Okay, Jew Not a Jew was a game show sketch on SNL that Tom Davis and I wrote, and basically it's a game show. Tom Hanks was the host that week, so he's the host of this game show, Jew Not a Jew, in which two different families are competing against each other, the Knutsons and the Jensens, and they have to guess whether celebrities are a Jew or not a Jew. So it'd be like Michael Landon, he was Charles Ingalls on Little House on the Prairie. Michael Landon, Jew or not a Jew? Take it, Jensens. We're going to say Jew, Bob. Ding, 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 ding. That was Jew, not a Jew. So thanks for your recollection.
So Frank Four, Al Franken, Jew.
Jews.
Okay.
Yes.
Established.
So what has been the reaction to this piece?
It's been intense. I've heard from, not surprisingly, a lot of American Jews who've told me that I had an intuition that things were going in the wrong direction, but you've been able to crystallize what I was thinking or feeling. Or people who told me I was trying to wish this all away. And the way that my mind was working was that I was just dismissing the evidence that I was seeing, but you've made it clear to me. And then, of course, you go on Twitter. As I write about in the piece, Twitter is a platform that's been taken over by a lot of white supremacists and anti-Semites. And lo and behold, they have pretty extreme reactions to my piece. When I say the end of the golden age of American Jewry is over, their response is, about time, thank God.
Did you get any reaction from Jews saying, don't write this?
You know, one thing that I think is interesting that I've seen is the complicated feelings that Jews have towards Israel come out in the course of this type of discussion, that there are a lot of Jews who feel like, you know, God, they want to blame the Israelis for the anti-Semitism that they see happening in the United States. At the same time, a lot of them would, you know, are thinking, well, maybe it's time to start thinking about migrating to Israel. and there are people who hold both of those sentiments in their mind at the same time.
Minnesota in Super Tuesday, 19% of Minnesotans voted uncommitted on the Democratic side, which I think is the highest percentage of any state thus far. We do have a large Muslim community, Somalis and Eritrean, Ethiopian. But also, this meant that a lot of young people, I think, this was the analysis in the New York Times, so it must be true. A lot of young people voted. And I guess that's dissatisfaction with Biden's conduct or support of Israel and its conduct of the war.
Yes.
That's the highest number I've seen. I've always thought that perhaps this golden age of American Jews is ending. Does that have anything to do with the distance from the Holocaust?
Absolutely. When we look at the years that followed World War II, you had this tremendously quick recession of anti-Semitism in America. Before World War II, you had Charles Lindbergh, you had Father Coughlin, you had a lot of street violence in New York City that was directed at Jews. And then World War II happens, the country commits itself to the struggle against Nazism, and the world learns about what the Nazis did. And very, very quickly, anti-Semitism starts to recede from American life. There had been quotas at elite universities restricting the presence of Jews. those were lifted in the 1950s and 1960s. There had been housing covenants, which shut Jews out of certain neighborhoods.
That was true in Minnesota. My mom was a real estate agent, and she would at dinner tell us about redlined areas. And it'd be weird. It'd be like across the street. It would be the exact same houses, you know, starter houses. One side would be Knutson's and Anderson's and Jensen's, and the other side would be Goldberg's, you know?
Right.
Just one side of the street, the same crappy ramblers.
That's the more nefarious version of Jew, not a Jew.
That's right.
You know, one of the details that have struck people in my piece is that I describe how in Roget's Thesaurus in 1937, the synonyms that were used for Jew, basically the dictionary of synonyms, that was on in every high school library. So the synonyms for Jews were conniving, nefarious,
yes.
untrustworthy. And so that I just point that out to show how quickly American life changed after World War II, and how what emerged in the years that followed World War II was really truly anomalous in the history of the world, because Jews weren't just tolerated in American life. They were admitted into elite institutions. They acquired real cultural and political influence. And if I were to describe this improperly, it would sound either like I'm a crank or a crazy ethnic booster. But it was just a reality that there was this period where the great American novel was the great Jewish novel. You had it's anti-Semitic to say that Jews run Hollywood, but Jews did invent the movie studios.
Right. And that was well before
World
War II.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
But they didn't star. Well, they did star Jews, but Jews who changed their names.
Exactly.
What was Kirk Douglas's name?
It was Isser Danielovich. Isser Danielovich.
Yeah, but people changed their names. You weren't a movie star in the 40s with that name, or 50s.
No. Did you ever think of changing your name, Al?
My name is so simple and to pronounce. Franken. That's my name. You knew that. It's easier than four, because four, you could go four. I mean, do you ever do the... It's four, right? It's like...
Yeah.
Just like the number four.
Yeah.
Even though it has an E in it. That's more complicated than Franken. Yeah. So the distance from the Holocaust. So when did this begin? When do you mark the golden era of American Jews beginning? Or is that a soft beginning?
It's a little bit soft. I mean, I would say it starts in the 50s.
Yep.
And I couldn't tell you, there was not a single moment where things changed. And one of the things that's hard is that after the Holocaust, Yale, at least, kept fighting to maintain its quotas. The Connecticut state legislature wanted to pass laws banning religious discrimination, which were largely aimed at taking down the quotas that Yale and some other institutions in Connecticut had. And Yale fought that even into the 1950s. And so it's kind of a rolling shift in American culture. But by the time you get to the late 1960s, it's clear that a revolution in American Jewish life has occurred. By the year 1969, 40% of the freshman class at Columbia University was Jewish. 19% of the professors at elite universities were Jewish. There had been Jewish Supreme Court justices, clearly, before the world. You had Brandeis, Frankfurter, and Cardozo. And then you had a rolling series of nominees in the 1960s. You had Arthur Goldberg, you had Abe Fortas. And then by the time you get to the 2000s, which is the culmination of this, you had three Jews on the Supreme Court at one moment, which is kind of an extraordinary thing, given that Jews are, I think, something like 4% of the American population.
So it's Kagan Breyer and
Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Oh, okay. Yep.
Sorry, to correct myself, Jews are 2.4% of the U.S. population.
And what of the world population? You have that statistic.
I think it was 0.2%.
0.2%.
Yeah.
And what percent of Nobel Prize winners?
Well, American Jews constitute, I think it was like 15%.
Now, again, I just should say we're both Jewish.
And neither of us has Nobel Prizes, which makes us demographic anomalies.
So You start your article in Berkeley, right?
Correct.
And this is the Bay Area. This shocked me, I have to say. The reason this shocked me is that, first of all, these demonstrations, pro-Palestinian demonstrations that they had in these schools, including elementary schools, this is right after October 7th. I mean, it's not like during the bombing, right?
Right.
So this is post-October 7th, and there's this Cornell professor who was, what did he say, exhilarated?
Exhilarated.
By October 7th?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's as bad as it gets. And I asked you what happened to that guy, and he took a leave of absence afterwards.
That's correct.
And apologized. He apologized, took a leave of absence. Okay, but tell us about what was going on in the Bay Area, because this was, to me, actually shocking.
Not long after October 7th, and I was seeing what was happening on college campuses and the like, and I was interested in this surge of anti-Semitism that we were hearing about anecdotally. And I started looking around and making calls, and I saw there was a city council hearing in Oakland that went viral. You had a procession of activists coming in and demanding that the Oakland City Council pass a resolution calling for a ceasefire. And there had been an amendment to that resolution.
Tell me the date of that.
I think we're talking early. It's late November, early December.
Oh, okay. So this is...
Yeah, so the bombing had already begun.
The bombing had begun.
And there were good reasons for people in the public to be upset about the bombing.
Including me at this point, you know.
But there was a Jewish city council member on the Oakland City Council who supported the ceasefire, but had introduced an amendment modifying the language of the ceasefire, because the ceasefire resolution had cast blame entirely in the direction of Israelis, and he wanted to introduce what seemed to me like a very uncontroversial sentence acknowledging what Hamas had done on October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were a procession of activists who went before the city council saying that this was white supremacism to talk about what had happened on October 7th, that it was an Israeli fabrication, what had happened. And so that amendment ends up losing. The activists' monologues become viral material. And I saw this and I was kind of horrified. Like, how can anybody deny what had happened in October 7th? I mean, it seems fair that somebody would want to end...
1,200 people killed
by
Hamas and torture. I mean, some of it was torture, rape and torture. I mean, it's the most hideous, unspeakable stuff.
Exactly. And also... you can't understand what had happened after October 7th, but it happened during the war, unless you understood that it had been provoked by Hamas, that Hamas was the one who actually launched the war by invading Israel.
Well, of course, I'm sure those activists in Oakland would say it had been provoked by Israel's existence. Well, or Israel just putting Palestinians in, you know, taking their land and building settlements where they shouldn't have built settlements to make a two-state solution unworkable.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that there's any justification for rape and murder, but you could argue.
No, there is none, but absolutely. But that's what they would have said.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's all right. So the thing that I think was striking to so many people watching this resolution was, why are city councils taking a stand against an event that's happening on the other side of the world when they don't tend to do foreign policy for the most part, and that's not their jurisdiction?
They do rent control more.
Exactly. Well, in fact, the Berkeley Rent Stabilization Board did indeed pass a resolution calling for a ceasefire.
Oh, that's right. That's why I thought of rent control. I read your article.
this was happening in every city council in the Bay Area and in other parts of the country as well, where you had very impassioned activists coming in and disrupting the business of these city councils until they passed these resolutions.
But what really struck me was the experience of the kids in their schools. That really struck me.
Well, so I was just explaining... there was a train of events. So I saw what was happening to city councils. I saw that there had been a menorah on Lake Merritt on the shores in downtown Oakland that had been dismembered and thrown into the sea, into the lake.
Lake, yeah.
And so the idea that this Jewish religious symbol was suddenly fair game and was something that could be dismantled, desecrated, and trashed in the name of the Palestinian cause felt to me like blatant anti-Semitism as you could get. And so I started making calls to people in the Bay Area, in the Jewish community. And I started hearing these stories about what was happening in the schools, that in Oakland, there had been a teach-in where groups affiliated with the local labor union, teachers union, had organized a teach-in where they were going to basically take a few hours out of the school to stop everything so that they could teach their classes about what was happening in Gaza. And it became very clear that teachers in the Bay Area wanted to mold their kids into activists who cared about this. They weren't teaching the complexities of the crisis. They were teaching this as a very, very black and white. Jews came in and stole land from Palestinians, even though there are a million problems with that historical narrative. And so what happens when you teach kids something in a very black and white sort of way, and you tell them Jews did something terrible, their natural response will be, these Jews are bad people, and they're not thinking about Jews on the Mediterranean Sea. They're talking about the Jews, they're thinking about the Jews in their classroom, and you have this horrible rise of bullying happening in classrooms. And despite all of the progressive instincts of people in the Bay Area, oftentimes it took the form of Nazi tropes.
Now let's get I want to interrupt you just to get the dates here, because this is what struck me, was that this was after October 7th, but before the bombing started. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, there is bombing that starts pretty soon after October 7th. And so some of this does happen. You have a lot of things blaming Israel that happen and decrying Israel that happen right after October 7th, when everything is still fresh, all the horrors are still fresh, and before Israel really has started to do anything. And then you have walkouts in some of these schools that start to happen before the campaign has really kicked in. It's clear Israel is about to do something retaliatory, but the retaliatory action hasn't actually started. And the walkouts happen in high schools, which is very scary to the Jewish students, because a lot of the language that the protesters are using calls for eliminating the state of Israel, but also they all felt like they'd heard even worse things that their classmates were chanting about the Jews. And I was never able to confirm that these things actually happened, but the kids were convinced that they'd heard their classmates saying horrible things about the Jews. And so they started to feel very, very panicked. Yeah, they were scared. And then it starts going down. I mean, what was fascinating to me about the situation in the schools is what starts in the high schools ends up migrating to some of the middle schools there, where you have 7th and 8th graders, you have 12 and 13-year-olds walking out of class in solidarity with the Palestinians. And then it goes down to even the middle, to the elementary schools, where you have reports of 2nd graders talking about how basically Israelis and Palestinians can't be friends, and asking people which side of the conflict that they're on, because it had been divided into this angels devils situation, and everybody wanted to be on the side, you know, to identify with the team of the angels. And when you're talking about the team of the devils, of course you're going to talk about them in a dehumanized sort of way.
There's always been anti-Semitism on the right. I mean, that's, you're talking about Father Coughlin and Lindbergh, and there's always been that. In Minnesota, there was that. Minnesota had a Jewish organized crime outfit in the north side of Minneapolis, and there was a lot of anti-Semitism. The Humphrey got them out of there, and they moved to Las Vegas. And that's, if you go see a movie called The Godfather 2, and they ended up there. So I always thought of anti-Semitism as something from the right. But now you're basically saying on college campuses and in Bay Area and in other places, you're seeing anti-Semitism.
Yeah. In the United States, I think it's fair to say that anti-Semitism has stronger roots on the right than on the left. I think globally, it's harder to make that argument. And you did see evidence of anti-Semitism on the left going back to the 1960s. And again, a lot of it at that time was connected to Israel, that when Israel became an enemy of the third worldist movements of the new left, of the Black Panthers, you know, a lot of that was draped in rhetoric that was anti-Semitic. And you had the whole controversy over whether Zionism is racism in the 1970s in the United Nations, which had rippling effects in the United States as well. But what happens, I think, in the 21st century is a time of rolling crises. You have 9/11, you have the Iraq War, you have the financial crisis, the rise of the Tea Party.
Let's talk about the Iraq War and 9/11, because you mark 9/11 in this as kind of the moment that this started to really get energy on the left.
Yes, that's right. Because in the 1990s were like this vacation from history for everybody. And it was for the Jews as well, that you had a lot of people in the Jewish community in the 1990s saying anti-Semitism is over in the United States, exists only in the fringes, only in the Nation of Islam, only in the deranged rantings of David Duke and Pat Buchanan. It's not actually a threatening feature in the mainstream of America.
Pat Buchanan had been in the White House, so you know, right, it's not right. Quite as fringe.
Right, and he captured a decent percentage of the Republican primary in 1992 when he ran against George H.W. Bush.
And he said there was a religious war in this country.
Right, right. But it was possible to listen to him say that there was a religious war and not think it was a religious war targeting Jews so much as it was religious versus... So 9/11 happens and you start to see for the first time in a long time anti-Semitic conspiracy theories taking hold. Some of them being spread on the internet, which is also a relatively new feature of modern life at that period. And some of them were truly deranged about how Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, had caused 9/11. But then there was a more refined version of that, which blamed 9/11 on American foreign policy and said that American foreign policy was actually being controlled by a bunch of Jews who were acting on dual loyalties to Israel and prodding the United States.
Wolfowitz and
William
Kristol and Rumsfeld takes offense.
Right. Rumsfeld says all these Jewish neocons are being blamed for the war, but it treats me like I have no agency in this matter. And I'm in fact the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah. Hey, come on. It's like me and Powell and Cheney. Come on.
Yeah,
we
for once, for
war.
Once, I mean, for once, Donald Rumsfeld is making sense.
he takes credit for starting the war in Iraq, I guess.
Yeah, I'll take the fall for that. You don't need to go blaming Jews.
He kind of did. Yeah. After the midterms in 2006, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. So this felt like a big deal to me. There was a book that was published called "The Israel Lobby" by Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, who were two important professors of international relations at Harvard and the University of Chicago. They argued in book-length form in a book published by a major publisher that became a New York Times bestseller, arguing that AIPAC and the Israel lobby was basically to blame for everything that was bad about American foreign policy. And you could hate AIPAC for its position on Israel, but what they were doing was falling back on a series of ancient tropes about how Jews were the secret puppet masters acting in the shadows, controlling the direction of society in a very underhanded, undemocratic sort of way.
And some of those puppet masters were people like George Soros, who literally in the 2022 race for Secretary of State in Minnesota, the Republican candidate for Secretary of State, in her speech, I think it was in her speech, she showed basically a cartoon of Soros manipulating her opponent. Right. Steve Simon, who's Jewish.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to be a master code breaker to see the code.
And that's, again, right-wing stuff. And we've seen that. And we saw it from Trump. We saw his last ad, his closing ad in 16.
Yes.
Had Soros and Janet Yellen and Lloyd Blankfein. I remember seeing that and going like, holy shit, that's yes. A pretty easily heard dog whistle.
I found that to be an extremely scary moment. And so as I'm watching this era in history unfold, my instinct, I think, is your instinct, and to say that the problem of anti-Semitism is a problem of the American right. And of course, when he comes to power, he does all sorts of other things to kind of wink in the direction of the white supremacists, including the famous "find people on both sides" quip, where
Jews will not replace us is what they're chanting.
Exactly. In the response to Donald Trump, you also have an atmosphere of fear and emergency and a sense of crisis developing on the American left. At the same time, you have changes in the Middle East. So one reason I think Israel in the 1990s wasn't a primary vector for anti-Semitic discourse was that you had a peace process that was on. It seemed like the world was moving, Israel and the Palestinians were moving towards a two-state solution.
And once Oslo fell apart.
Exactly. So once Oslo falls apart, the pro-Palestinian camp ends up taking a different sort of direction rather than push. You have a second intifada. You have a boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement start to develop.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Frank Foer of the Atlantic Monthly.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than just a car or a house. It's the four wheels that get you where you're going and the four walls that welcome you home. When you combine auto and home insurance with Amica, we'll help protect it all. And the more you cover, the more you can save. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
When did Netanyahu become prime minister first?
In the 90s, for a time after the Rabin assassination, after Perez.
Now, Netanyahu, to me, is, you know, someone who I fiercely detest. And I think he is in large part responsible for deliberately making a two-state solution impossible.
Without a doubt.
I mean, that's something, and you say without a doubt, so that's undeniable. And he has been in power for so long there that he's been able to make that happen. And they still, even after all of this, still will not say we need a two-state solution.
So that is all true. But it's also true that he wasn't always a Likud leader during this period, that you had a time when Ehud Olmert was the leader of the Likud party. And in 2008, presented the Palestinians with the most generous offer that they've been presented with from the Israeli side about a two-state solution.
Mm-hmm.
And it was rejected. And you know, while he was making that offer, the world was already moving in the direction of boycotting, divesting, and sanctioning Israel and treating Israel as if it was a pariah. All of which is to say is that the whole narrative is very jumbled and complicated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, while there are villainous characters in this, in the narrative from the Israeli perspective, in the Palestinian perspective, anybody who reduces it in that sort of binary sort of way, in my view, ends up trampling over very, very important nuances in the narrative.
Of course.
So Israel starts to get treated in a toxic sort of way. And then you have a new gestalt starting to emerge on the American left, where the world gets divided into, in a very binary sort of way, between the white supremacists and the oppressors and their victims. There's a theory that starts to take hold on the left about intersectionality, which is based on a very reasonable assumption that you can't just address discrimination in one particular form. You can't just focus on racial discrimination or gender discrimination, right, because they compound one another. And we need to think about discrimination in a holistic sort of way, which makes sense as a legal theory and as a social analysis, but it becomes problematic when it becomes a guiding ideology for a social movement. And there becomes a party line that you have to adopt in order to be a member of the left in good standing in the 2010s. And being anti-Zionist increasingly becomes part of the litmus test for getting admitted into left-wing coalitions. This is something I saw pretty close to home. My daughter was very active in the Sunrise Movement, which is a climate justice movement, and they were organizing a protest for voting rights in Washington, D.C. There were groups, there was a Jewish Women's Council and a couple other Jewish groups that were going to be part of this coalition to push for voting rights. But the Sunrise Movement in D.C. kicked them out of this coalition, basically said they wouldn't march with them because they supported Israel, and that it was just an moral abomination to normalize the Zionists. Now, they were talking about the most crunchy, most progressive Jews you could imagine, who have lots of their own criticisms of Israel. They're anti-Netanyahu. We're not talking about settlers. We're not talking about people who are ethno-nationalists. You're talking about Birkenstock wearing people who march all the time.
So let me ask you this. So the people that don't want them, won't want to march with them, they are anti-Zionist. Does this mean they're saying kick the Jews out of Palestine? In other words, what are they suggesting?
That is an excellent question. And
finally,
I've been sitting here waiting, Al.
Yeah, and
it's,
okay.
I think it's just like the,
finally, a excellent question. Excellent question.
Right.
What are they suggesting? I mean,
so I think it really depends who you're talking to and how much they know about what they're talking. So there are some people who I respect who argue that there should be a binational solution to the conflict. So you'd have one state where Israelis and Palestinians would get along in a kumbaya sort of way and participate in a democracy where everybody has equal rights.
Okay. You, in your article, write about this, and you have your doubts about the wisdom of that.
It seems naive to me in the extreme, just given the histories that we're dealing with.
So you're for a two-state solution.
I'm a two-state solution guy.
Right.
Right. And then there are other people, and I think you'd put Hamas in this category, and you'd put maybe the mainstream of a lot of Palestinian politics in that just wishes that the residents of Tel Aviv would pack up and move to Brooklyn, and that Israel would just simply disappear, you know, as a historical footnote.
Remember when Albert Brooks did a film of Georgia and Israel changing their populations, changing, and the governor of Georgia goes, "We look forward to heat without humidity."
Where were we?
I'm sorry.
I can pick this up. All right. So you have all sorts of instances in the 2010s where Jewish groups on campus, Jewish groups on the left, start to be excluded from the broader progressive family. And one of the most striking things that happens on college campuses is that you have Hillel, which is the center of all Jewish life. It's where kids go for Shabbat dinner. It's where religious services are held. It's where all the communal functions exist on
Shabbat
a
dinner
campus.
For the few Gentiles who listen to this, Sabbath dinner Friday exactly. night. Yes.
And it's not just Jews who are, my daughter, who's in university now, goes to Hillel, and she almost always goes with her Gentile friends, because it's hard to stand between a college student of any ethnicity or religion and a free meal.
A free good meal.
Yes, exactly.
With chicken. Sure.
And that Manischewitz wine. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. the pound the Manischewitz. So Hillel gets disinvited from these coalitions. You have these, again, extremely progressive rabbis on these college campuses who view themselves as being at the total vanguard of LGBTQ plus rights. And then they're told, you know what? You can't participate in our coalition for LGBTQ rights because you're pro-Israel.
And we see this in your article at Columbia.
Yes.
You go back to your alma mater and you talk to this reporter for the school news. What is it called?
The Spectator.
The Spectator, which watches stuff. Yes. And then writes about it. Anyway, so she does that about a woman punching a guy, right?
Yeah, yeah. So there was an assault, allegedly, that took place outside of Butler Library, where a guy was hanging up posters of hostages, gets punched. She writes the story up and writes it in a very neutral way, double checks everything. It's impeccably done. And yet the next morning, she finds herself on the receiving end of all of these threatening messages, which identify her as being Jew and accusing her of religious bias and accusing her of being a Zionist. And she starts to feel unsafe on campus, because when a dean had talked to the Israeli student, he'd said, the school can't protect you on campus. You're probably better leaving campus. And so she ended up leaving campus herself. And when she came back, when the university assured her of her safety, she started to do some reporting about what Jewish students were experiencing and feeling after October 7th. And she talked to dozens of students and found that there were dozens of incidents of harassment and hostility. A lot of it happening anonymously. There is a form of social media that exists on college campuses called Side Chat, which you have to, in order to enter Side Chat, you have to enter in a university email address, but everything you say is anonymous. And mostly it's used for gossip and trivial happenings on campus. But after October 7th, it was used by students to identify who was a Zionist. And there were examples of people identifying the room of certain Zionist on campus so that they could go slap posters on those rooms, and people would talk about how they wanted to trash these rooms. And so the anonymity of it all increased the sense of menace, because you had no idea if it was the person you were sitting across from in class who was seething at you for being a Zionist. And then she found other examples of professors and TAs saying all sorts of things to Israeli and Jewish students that made them feel as if they might pay an academic penalty for expressing pro-Israel sentiments or even for being Jewish.
There's a number that haunts you. 1 in 5 non-Jewish students wouldn't want to be friends with someone who supports the existence of Israel as a Jewish state. This is a study done on these kind of views. And to me, that means 4 out of 5 would be.
Yeah.
Would be friends. I think that's good.
You know,
it haunts you.
Glass half empty, or glass four-fifths
full. Four-fifths full. My God. I saw that number and I went, that's pretty good. Yeah. Okay.
Well, it reminds me of a joke where the Jewish pessimist says, things can't get any worse. And the Jewish optimist says, yes, they can.
I've never heard that. That is a great joke.
Thank you.
Now, did this cause the hearings that Claudine Gay and the University of Pennsylvania and MIT appeared at?
Yeah. So, well, I should say that at all these schools, there was pressure to put out statements after October 7th expressing what the institutional view on the attacks were. And, you know, universities are always going to have a hard time commenting on something like this, even if the morality of what happened on October 7th should be very easy to describe. Yes. They're places that have, they're not places that are adept at putting out political statements. They're not places that are adept at navigating multiple constituencies.
That kind of came through in the hearing.
Yeah. And I think that especially with regard to Jewish suffering, I think it's very hard because there isn't this vocabulary that the left has for talking about anti-Semitism. In a world where everything is about oppressors and oppressed or about privilege or about supremacy, the problem with anti-Semitism as a concept is it breaks people's brains. The anti-Semitism is actually an accusation of privilege. It's this accusation that Jews have too much power, that they wield too much power. And so the whole vocabulary, the whole series of taxonomies that we have for thinking about racism and discrimination in society don't really have a place for anti-Semitism in them. And I think that's been part of the reason why universities have struggled to talk about anti-Semitism in a way that feels like they have their heart in it. And that's what Jewish students feel, is that the universities don't have their heart in their protection. And I actually don't think Claudine Gay or the president of the University of Pennsylvania should have been fired, because I don't think that they, you know, they choked in that hearing and they gave terrible answers.
Let me ask you what the answer you would have given had you been one of them. To me, it was, well, yeah, if someone is in a demonstration where it says from the river to the sea and they're at Harvard, they should know what that means. But should they be expelled? No, I don't think so. They should be, someone should talk to them and see what they're thinking.
I mean, the question was more specific than that. It was whether calls for the genocide of Jews is harassment.
Well, that is, yes.
Yeah. And so I think you just say it is.
But I think she equated that.
It's a despicable sentiment, and it is a form of harassment. I don't know what the discipline should be, or if there should, you know, if there will necessarily be discipline for that, because
but she framed it that way. I heard her frame it that way in terms of the river to the sea, and that is calling for the.
But she choked on a very specific question that had a very easy answer because she was so afraid of saying the morally clear thing about the morally clear situation.
But she also, I think, ultimately had to leave because of plagiarism, accusations of plagiarism, which you get expelled for at Harvard if you do that.
That is fair enough. Right.
No, but I agree with you. I thought they were all choking, and it was mind-boggling that, you know, from these three schools.
But I think we have to say it's symptomatic of something. That it's symptomatic of the way in which bureaucratic-minded administrators struggle to speak with moral clarity and forcefulness on certain things that should be morally clear and that require moral forcefulness. And that I really do think that there is something about, I hate to use the DEI because I think it's not exactly what we're talking about, but the worldview of the academic left and of the kind of the institutions themselves, really, they don't have the language or the moral imagination to actually think about anti-Semitism in a clear sort of way. And that means when they're confronted with an example, even a hypothetical one, of rank anti-Semitism, they don't know how to respond to it.
Yes, at Columbia, they finally did something, right? In terms of...
they have a task force. And the task force
they appointed a task force to look at anti-Semitism at school.
It gets complicated because there are issues of free speech involved, and universities, I think when they think about themselves, think about academic freedom as being at the center of their self-conception. But they're also rules-based institutions, and a lot of the demonstrations at these universities blatantly break the rules. And so the point of having free speech is not that you have free speech everywhere at all times, but even free speech is constrained by a set of boundaries that are established. And there were groups on campus, especially at Columbia, that had apparently broken through those boundaries, and the university banned them temporarily. So they did take action.
Let me ask you, the golden age of American Jews is ending. How much do you tie that to this coming election? In other words, I feel that Trump has stoked anti-Semitism in a number of things that he has done, including that ad we talked about, and including saying there are good people on both sides. How much do you tie that to Trump, and how much is just not?
I tie it to, I'd say a couple things about this. One is anti-Semitism in this country is not merely a product of Donald Trump. It's not merely a phenomenon that exists on the right. And we can say that now as clearly as ever after October 7th, because there's so much evidence that shows that that's not the case. But that being said, a lot of Jews that I know take the threat of Donald Trump, and they think about it through a very Jewish lens, because they saw the way in which he winked at the anti-Semites the last time around, and that there is something about the demagogic leader who makes populist appeals, who triggers historic memories that are pretty fresh in the mind of most Jews, and that scare the bejesus out of them.
They're poisoning the blood.
Can you scare the bejesus out of a Jew?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
Things like they're poisoning, the immigrants are poisoning the blood of America.
Right. I mean, it's
that's
not hard
very
to...
Hitler.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it is.
That's directly from Mein Kampf, basically.
Right. There's no way to kind of say it differently. And that's why he's scary. After the 2016 election, a lot of people in Blue America made empty threats about leaving the country in the eventuality of Trump. But the Jews that I know actually went about implementing those plan Bs because they were afraid. I know so many people who've gone and gotten passports to European countries. And there's an irony there. It's like Germany has laws that allow descendants of the Holocaust to get German passports. And so you have people thinking about Germany as a plausible plan B for, you know, the eventuality of Trump coming to power. And I know people who've got houses or, shop for real estate in other countries, and in order to have that kind of safety valve, I think because those historic memories for Jews are so fresh, so deeply implanted, you take something like the Passover Seder, where you say every year, in the celebration of freedom, you say in every age, essentially, there is somebody who will hate the Jews, who will rise to power and, implement a plan to do away with them. It's just a ritualized part of Jewish memory. And I think it's how Jews can't help but process Trump and everything that's happened after October 7th.
Well, obviously, I hope Biden wins, and obviously, we know that's what the contest is, Biden versus Trump, and oh boy,
yeah,
that's what I have to say. Oh boy, well, thanks, Frank.
I think an Oy Gevalt would be more in order.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.